Breakthrough.
You are now listening to Breakthrough News. It's 5 p.m. You're listening to Breakthrough News, and this is The Punch Out. We're following the news all day so you don't have to, giving you everything you need to know about what's in the headlines and what should be. And yes, we are back here on The Punch Out, 16th of August, 2022. Very happy to be back with you here on the show. And today on the show, we've got plenty for you. As we always do, we're going to be talking about Kenya's very recent presidential election, which, in addition to being very important for that country, is a bellwether for a lot of what's happening on the African continent. The current deputy president of Kenya, William Ruto, has emerged victorious in Kenya's election this week, narrowly besting former Prime Minister Raila Odinga by just a couple hundred thousand votes. The vote was widely watched around the world as Kenya is one of the most prominent countries in Africa economically, socially, and politically. Kenya has Africa's seventh largest GDP and the second most prominent stock exchange after South Africa. The capital of Nairobi hosts the headquarters of a number of important international organizations, like the United Nations Environment Program. And Kenya also has one of the most well-known anti-colonial struggles with the Land and Freedom Army, or the Mau Mau, who fought in the 1950s against British colonialism, being symbols of struggle all across the continent and the world to this day. Kenya also has been the scene of some notoriously violent elections, where ethnic-based violence in particular has seriously destabilized the country at times. So all that being said, many were looking to the Kenyan elections for not only Kenya itself, but what a changing of the guard in Nairobi might mean and say about the region and the continent overall. And here are a few of our thoughts on exactly those questions. First, Kenya's election is an important bellwether for the continent, mainly because Kenya's election turned not on ethnicity, but on class and income inequality this time, and Ruto won mainly by promising a more equitable future. Ruto's campaign had a catchy slogan that he was representing the quote-unquote hustler nation. He was speaking to the spirit of so many Kenyans who, locked out of the formal economy or stuck at its lowest rungs, pride themselves on their hustling skills, just finding a way to make it, regardless of the cost. So Ruto's supporters throughout the campaign referred to themselves as the hustlers. Ruto promised to help the hustler nation through something called bottom-up economics, which we'll get to later, that placed the focus on the many over the few, at least rhetorically. And this is important for Kenya and the continent in terms of what it signals. Africa is the world's youngest continent, and it's becoming increasingly clear that political elites, of which Ruto is one, are under increasing pressure in just about every country to improve the standard of living. The youth of Africa, who are mainly poor and working class, do not want to see the future their parents did of living in neo-colonial, neoliberal, Western client states where poverty, inequality, and the lack of social services is the norm. Whether we are discussing the political turmoil in South Africa, the mass protests that have swept West Africa in the past few years, the politics of the resistance committees fighting the government in Sudan, the underlying reasons behind the anti-TPLF revolt in Ethiopia several years back, or the current response of the governments in Uganda, Zimbabwe, and Angola to electoral challenges this year and next, the one thread that runs between them all is the only political appeal that seems to truly be able to gain traction and potentially consolidate broad unity are the appeals that are centered on broad-based development that can drastically improve people's standard of living. So, if nothing else, Kenya's election is just another indicator of this broad trend. The people of Africa want to be liberated from neocolonialism and are increasingly, in a variety of ways, making that clear, with both truly progressive political formations and opportunistic political elites deploying developmentalist rhetoric to build their organizations, campaigns, and brands. Kenya's election is also an indicator that increasingly large numbers of people don't believe in the ability of traditional African political elites, or even perhaps the political systems themselves, to deliver this kind of change. The Kenyan election had, by U.S. standards, a high turnout of 65%. But it was the lowest election result in Kenya in a presidential level for 15 years. And in particular, the youth vote accounted for a good amount of the drop in participation. About 40% of registered voters this year were young people. That's a 5% decline from the election in 2017. And there were similar trends in the most recent elections in both South Africa and Uganda. And notably, Kenya had actually been trying for a couple years to buck this trend by doing extensive outreach to young voters, which, it seems, didn't make much of a difference. This shouldn't really be terribly surprising, the voter turnout dropping, when you think the last 30 or more years of social and economic results all across the continent are obviously not going to really breed confidence that political systems made up of a variety of people that are a part of the failed political establishment, even if there's various rebrands or new parties or whatever, are actually going to do what they say, particularly since it's not the first, and oftentimes probably the third or fourth time, many of these voters are hearing sweet promises that came with very little follow-through. So again, an important indicator that people are increasingly voting with their feet across the African continent, staying away, making the implicit statement that a new society needs a new politics, or at least that the old politics better show some real change, and soon. In terms of the specifics of Ruto's program, when you look at it, you can see how it does reflect, in fact, the pressures being put on many African elites to deliver a new future. In political science terminology, Ruto's platform could basically be termed as a form of quote-unquote social liberalism, something that a lot of Western European countries or even Canada have these days, where the economy is certainly organized along capitalist lines, but the government tries to throw in various social programs to make things a bit better for the lower rungs and more comfortable for the middle layers. Ruto is putting a lot of emphasis on increasing export-based agriculture, since agriculture is still the largest business in Kenya, and also improving the quote-unquote business environment for small and medium-sized businesses, the hustlers, if you will. This is not a huge paradigm shift, but it does do a few things. By bringing people into the formal economy, helping businesses regularize their operations, and providing them with economic aid, which Ruto is promising to do, a lot of more aid for small and medium-sized businesses, you can, of course, increase economic activity, but also, and crucially, it'll increase tax revenue because businesses that are formalized, of course, have to pay taxes. And ultimately, it's fairly clear that Ruto hopes by strengthening the core sector of agriculture and trying to give a little juice to the existing small and medium-sized business sector, that he can grow the economy and bring in more tax revenue to cover some of the social aspects of his program. Currently in Kenya, about 60% of Kenyans live in slums or other substandard forms of housing. Ruto is promising to increase the building of affordable housing to address this, saying that he'll go from the building of 50,000 affordable housing units a year to 250,000 a year by the end of his term, and to increase low-cost mortgages from 30,000 to a cumulative 1 million by the end of his term. He's also proposing to expand the national health care plan of Kenya from 40% of people enrolled to 100% of people enrolled, and to reduce the out-of-pocket expenses for people who are enrolled in the national health insurance plan, which has hobbled its rollout and success so far. Ruto and his Kenya Kwanza Alliance are also promising a major build-out of roads, electrical vehicle infrastructure, and electricity overall, all of which also cost money. And Kenya already has a fairly high debt load. They pay about $12 billion a year in debt service. So clearly the social element of his program will be hard to manage without increasing the amount of revenue brought in by the government. Either way, to swing back around to the earlier point, clearly you can see the Kenya Kwanza program fronted by Ruto is aimed directly at those who have gained the least from the past Kenyan governments and is designed to promise them a significantly better future. How much better, though, is a big question. The economic program is, as stated earlier, not much of a paradigm shift, and ultimately its silence on the key questions, which is the political economy of imperialism, suggests that it won't be that transformative. Ultimately, when you look at the global economy, it's clear that it's dominated by the global north through the exploitation of the global south, broadly speaking. All of the quote-unquote developed countries in the world, and that's the benchmark that developing countries like Kenya say that they want to reach, are countries that only reach that level for geopolitical reasons. They were allowed significant preferential access to U.S. markets for high-value goods and significant roles in the production chain for high-tech goods as part of the broader overall strategy to challenge socialism in the socialist camp during the Cold War. These days, the geopolitical winds are blowing in a very different direction. In fact, the topic of discussion at big economic forums like the ASEAN summit this year was the very fact that the U.S. is no longer offering that kind of access to anyone who ain't in already. China is obviously the most successful newly developing country, but it's a cautionary tale for countries who think they can work the broader capitalist supply chain reality in order to lift themselves up to a powerful developed world, because in China, you can see that the conflict with the U.S. has come precisely at the point that it was clear capitalism was not subordinating and taming China, but that China was leveraging its role in global capitalist supply chains to create companies that could challenge the West at basically all levels. So more or less, the moment China moved from subordinate to potential peer, the West decided to pivot to Asia and try to contain it. So in reality, the only way to become quote-unquote developed in the current imperialist context is to be totally politically subordinated to the United States, to not in any way challenge U.S. global hegemony or the leading role of the largest corporations in the G7 world. Ultimately, it means that a country's success, in this case, is totally predicated on carrying out U.S. policy positions in your given region or challenging them. And even if you totally carry out those policies, the chances of getting the sort of boost the U.S. gave South Korea and Japan is, quite frankly, very slim. So without a doubt, Ruto in the abstract can improve economic and social outcomes for Kenyans right now in the current setup. But really, he can only increase Kenya's role in an already subordinated niche unless he wants to confront the West more seriously. Now, of course, Ruto does say that he wants to have good relations with the West and China, but the West is increasingly making it clear they won't allow that, and they are in fact trying to force countries to choose sides, despite their rhetoric to the contrary. So to take advantage of things like the African Continental Free Trade Area that opens up a huge scope for African countries to cooperate with each other ultimately means a challenge to the paradigm of the global north exploiting the global south, which ultimately means challenging the major Western powers, something that Ruto has not in any way, shape, or form indicated he wants to do. So ultimately, some improvement, sure, but game-changing improvement, probably not likely. And while we're on foreign policy, regionally, Ruto's platform has been relatively slim, relatively cagey. But in East Africa especially, Ruto defeating Odinga, who the current president Uhuru Kenyatta endorses as his successor, has been hailed as a significant change for the region. Kenya's large Somali population in particular seemed to rally heavily to Ruto, partially in response to Kenyatta's Somali policies that basically consisted of occupying a large swath of the southern part of Somalia and just looting it. What exactly Ruto will do in relationship to Somalia isn't entirely clear, but if you can to some degree judge from the views of some of his more prominent supporters with knowledge and involvement in Somalia, it seems likely he will be far more friendly to the broader process of ultimately removing the AU quote-unquote security mission, lifting the arms embargo on Somalia, and generally supporting the more nationalistic forces in the country who want to move away from clan-based politics and want to move towards one-person, one-vote elections in the next period. And also, it likely means being hostile to formalizing the status of Somaliland, a breakaway region of Somalia, which is trying to declare independence formally with the backing of the U.S. and the U.K. under an explicit program of being a bulwark for Western policies in the Horn. Uhuru Kenyatta, the outgoing president of Kenya, has also generally been favorable to the TPLF and the current conflict in Ethiopia. So much so that the TPLF has been working hard to make him the chief mediator in a potential peace process, attempting to displace the AU from its current leading role in a potential peace process. With Ruto as Kenya's president, it seems highly unlikely that the Kenyan government will support Kenyatta playing such a role, and far more likely that they will rally behind the AU-led peace process. And this is important because the AU has generally approached the issue as a more or less unprovoked insurgency by the TPLF and treats Ethiopia's current government as legitimate. For the TPLF, this is a big problem because a major part of their negotiating strategy is to start from the premise that Ethiopia's government is illegitimate, so that way they can claim a larger share of power for themselves. Ruto's win, then, seems likely to close down one avenue for them to accomplish that goal. He also has, in his support base, some influential Kenyan supporters of Ethiopia's ruling Prosperity Party. Also among Ruto's prominent supporters are a few strong supporters of Eritrea. It's hard to say if Ruto will develop any sort of deep relations there, but even just a public, mildly friendly posture from Ruto towards Eritrea will carry serious weight since Kenya plays a big role on the continent and in the United Nations, which ultimately means it will complicate the attempts of the United States and European Union to isolate Eritrea. There's also wide scope for the two countries to cooperate on issues of common concern, in particular Somali stability and security, and regarding Ethiopia, and that could certainly go a long way to helping promote the AU, quote, African solutions to African problems, end quote, approach to conflicts on the continent, which, all else being equal, is bad news for the various U.S. and EU schemes to use military forces to deepen their neo-colonial control of Africa. All that being said, the concerns of those who didn't vote and feel disaffected from the system about whether or not Ruto can accomplish all this are certainly well-founded. Ruto appealed to the hustlers by citing his own history of coming from a very poor background to becoming one of the richest and most powerful people in the country. However, that means his history is heavily bound up in the corrupt nexus of business and politics that has failed Kenya for so many years. So will he strike out in a new direction? Will he slaughter the sacred cows? Will he challenge the entrenched interest and many more metaphors? It's a very big open question, a very big one. There's also the issue of being able to challenge these interests successfully, even if you want to, in the current framework. The Kenyan elections had a lot of talk about the deep state, quote unquote, that controls politics. And while some of that is undoubtedly overblown, there's a clear truth to the fact that in basically all of the so-called liberal democracies around the world, there's a shadow power of wealth and privilege that's entrenched in the state and in civil society that really controls the nature of politics in the country and can't just be turned around legislatively. So how far will Ruto push? We'll have to see. And how much resistance will he meet? Well, those two things coming together will determine a lot about the future of Kenya. All told, though, it's clear Kenya's election sends a very clear signal about Africa's future. It's a battleground on the continent between those who are seriously willing to challenge neocolonialism and those who just want to talk about it. That's the punch out for today. We're with you Monday through Friday, 5 p.m. here in New York, East Coast Standard Time, 2 p.m. in Los Angeles, Pacific Standard Time, and 9 p.m. GMT. And of course, you can support everything we do here at Breakthrough News at patreon.com/breakthroughnews. It's your patronage that keeps all of our offerings here at Breakthrough News moving forward. And of course, you can check us out across all your social media platforms, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, at BT Newsroom.